Welcome to Inaudible. I'm your host, Jeremy Weiland, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Reddy. On this podcast, we discuss the weird, beautiful channeled messages found in the long tradition of contact with the Confederation of Planets in service to the One Infinite Creator. These messages articulate a philosophy of spiritual evolution, popularly known as the Law of One. Many of these messages are available to listen to on our sister podcast, Living Love and Light, available on all platforms. We seek to provide analysis and commentary on this philosophy described in these messages, identifying the common themes and grappling with the application of this information to our human lives. However, we are not counselors, gurus, or experts of any kind, so please evaluate our words in light of our shortcomings and use your own best judgment. Thanks for listening. Happy Saturday, Nathan. How you doing?
Pretty good. How are you, man?
I'm good. I'm just finished my third week at a new job. It's going really well. I really like the pace, and it's an upgrade from what I had before. So I'm really enjoying it, and just waiting for the other shoe to drop. But that's just well, that's just how I am.
Congratulations! It's, you're still in the honeymoon period, but no, exactly. Hopefully you like it a lot.
Yeah. And just I'm a little bit fatigued today because I stayed out late dancing last night with my friends. But I think I'm all right. I think I got enough coffee in me, and I've done a little bit of studying of the stuff we're going to talk about. I feel like we're ready. What about you, Nathan? What's going on with you?
Nothing much. Just in the still in the house search. It's been 3 years. 7 or 8 offers, different places. It's just a hot market here in SoCal. So still in the search, but it's a marathon, not a sprint. Otherwise, just doing the daily things. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I know there's a lot of our listeners who really want us to revisit the archetypes with Steve Timon and do that part 2, but he's needed a little bit of time. So we're going to hold off on that. And in the meantime, Nathan and I are going to record on some topics that we're interested in until we can get back to that subject. Hopefully next time you can join us, Nathan. What we wanted to talk about today was the shadow self. This concept that does occur pretty frequently throughout the channeling library of both LO Research and the working group. And this shadow self can be seen as a site for describing and discussing a lot of different concepts in spiritual evolution. I wanted to start with a kind of definition of this, at least not from a confederation or channeling point of view, but just from a psychological point of view. Shadow self and the dark side of the self, these are things that have been talked about in pop culture. And a lot of that stems from the work of Freud and Jung and all of these psychologists. Carl Jung first developed the concept to describe the things people repress or do not like to acknowledge within themselves. He theorized that it is a counterweight to the persona being the self that people present to others. So you're presenting this persona, but it's not your full self. So that other remainder has to go somewhere. And I think from his point of view, from Jung's point of view, this ability to repress things that you do not like or do not wish to show others has a lot of consequences psychologically. And we would argue from a spiritual point of view, energetically, right? And so what we're interested in today are understanding those dynamics, because it seems as if by working with the shadow self, one can sort of recover that sense of wholeness that that you as an entity actually are in possession of. You are not simply the personality that you project to others in this world. You are a three, as Carla Ruckert described it through Kuo often, you're a 360-degree being, a being both of the light and of the dark. Anything you want to add to that, Nathan, before we jump into quotes?
Yeah, actually, I have a question for you, and so we'll see where this takes us. So the question is this. You know, you mentioned the concept of repression, And I think certainly we would all agree that as a practical matter in this day and age, a lot of us, I mean, there's active repression. But my question is, how much of the repression that occurs in third density is maybe a natural state? Because, right, if we're not describing repression as something that maybe is something that automatically occurs, are we then saying that a newly minted, so to speak, third density entity doesn't repress their shadow self? Is this purely acquired over the course of incarnations, multiple incarnations? Because the first incarnation is third density self, or maybe at some point, maybe they started acquiring it in second density. Or are we saying that repression, maybe because of the veil, is something that is, although we can definitely add to it by consciously repressing things, there is an aspect of the separation of the self into the shadow self and the non-shadow self, the light self, that's innate as a part of the veil.
Mm-hmm. So I'm sure the veil plays a role in this. This is my opinion, by the way, guys. I don't know.
No, this is speculating. The truth. You're the authority on the subject. That's why I'm asking. No, just kidding.
I'm not wearing my fez. Whenever I'm not wearing my fez, you can disregard me. No, I think I am sure that the veil creates the possibility of a repository of consciousness that we don't have to give our awareness to, that we don't have to give the focus of our attention to. That alone creates the possibility of repression being actually effective at what it's designed to do, which is to weed out these things that we don't want to think about that are nevertheless ourselves. So we have a kind of chosen, constructed self. And it wouldn't be possible to do that in such a totalizing way if we didn't have the veil, a kind of garbage chute that we can throw things in, right? Now, I want to say that I think what actually makes repression possible is the self-consciousness that is introduced by the spirit complex being a part of the mind-body-spirit complex in third density. I mean, look at animals. They're not really repressing anything, right? Unless they're trained to, they are in full expression of whatever occurs to them at any given moment. We, however, because we have the ability to reflect on that mind-body feedback loop with the spirit complex in a feedback loop, we have the ability to look at ourselves and see whether or not that's something we want to accept. And that reflectiveness allows for us to even conceive of the idea of curating that self with the act of repression and constructing a persona, a personality that can then go out and meet the world in that yellow ray, third density social setting. After all, remember, like, the constructed personality that I project to others as Jeremy, I mean, that's a very yellow ray creation. From this point of view, in the sense that it's because others see me and form judgments, just like I see me and form judgments, that it's so important to regulate this. It's a social thing. And frankly, it's absolutely necessary in the third density world. If we were to give complete license to all of our impulses, we would not be successful at creating a stable society. And so over and over again, even when societies collapse, you see them reconstitute something that has some, you know, stability and staticness to it that people can rely upon. And then they build personalities around that social setting. Personalities that use the social matrix, the yellow ray social matrix, the way that a car uses the interstate system, right? Like, yeah. It's a vehicle designed to interact with a aspect of reality. It's not the whole reality, but it's important to understand that in constructing these social selves, until we have gotten a more enlightened, a more totalizing and 30,000 foot view of ourselves, and can accept everything, it's always going to involve some kind of repression.
You know, and speaking of acceptance and repression, I think it's worth commenting, because I see this all the time, and we've talked about this numerous times, but for whatever reason, the societal understanding of acceptance, even in religious context, is so misplaced. It's often associated with inaction, right? When that's not usually, I often find true acceptance, which means you're accepting whatever's bothering you. But, you know, true acceptance is unconditional acceptance. You're accepting what's bothering you, but you're also accepting yourself. It almost always results in action. Almost always results in action. And so often, I mean, I see it so often. A reason it came up is I was randomly watching, for those of you who've seen Breaking Bad, I was randomly just watching a clip that came up on through the YouTube algorithm of basically the one where they're at the AA meeting and he's talking about the reason he's there is to sell meth. And he's like, do you accept that? They're talking about acceptance. And the counselor's like, no, I don't accept that. Right. But once again, and then the comment section, it's a misunderstanding of what acceptance means. Right. Because it's not just accepting something in a void. It's accepting everything. And if you truly accept everything, you'll often take action. But it will be from a place of balance. And this is ideally, of course. Acceptance isn't necessarily a Boolean on or off switch. It's a kind of a journey. But as you get closer and closer to true acceptance, you might not be offended or angry at what happened as much. Right? And you'll maybe begin to forgive, but you'll still take action because you also have to accept yourself about your orientation as to your needs and what you want on the situation. Right?
Yep. The mantra that I often use is that acceptance does not mean approval, right?
Exactly.
I am not, there are many things within me that I am aware of that I disapprove of, that I wouldn't want other people to know about me, my hidden thoughts, you know, whatever. The struggle is to accept them as myself, even though I don't like them.
Right.
Because then I can because that's the opening to finding a way in which I can relate to it that is positive, that can be loving. It's not necessarily the first way that occurs to my mind. I think Monka said something to this effect, like with other people, it's like, you know, like you don't have to regard whoever you meet in exactly the first way that occurs to you when you meet them. Like your first impressions, like you can stick with that, but you don't have to. You can interrogate it, you can modify it, mm-hmm. You can dig deeper. And I think it applies even more so with the self. When you find something in yourself that you don't like, and I mean, it is automatic to repress. In a lot of ways, you know, all repression might be said to be born of your mom or dad saying no when you were little. That is a state in which we were trying to express ourselves unselfconsciously, right? Like just giving expression to anything that occurs to us. And then sort of seeing the response to that as kind of dialing us into how we can have effective yellow ray vehicles for the social matrix. Now that's important. You have to do that, and that's socialization. It actually makes me wonder sometimes if that process doesn't happen in some parallel sense in other domains of existence or consciousness, right? Like,
right.
It might just not have this destructive aspect to it of, hey, I push something down and then it pops up sometime later in some oblique form that I don't even realize until it's too late, you know?
Yeah. And I think it's fair to mention also, and important to mention that these days, and even in the past, it's not just socialization and repression from interaction with parents, but nowadays it extends to TV, social media, early friendships, right? You'll be in daycare before even elementary school, right? Or elementary school. And the way, your friends interact with you, the way what you see on social media, it plays a huge role, especially when you're so young, right? Because you don't really have the resources or experience to really understand fully what's happening, right? Someone might be saying no to you because they're super stressed out. But when you're 4 or 5, you don't understand those dynamics. You think it's about you, right?
Yeah. And it's so of course it's going to trigger catalysis within you that you then have the ability to work with or shunt away, right? And then it's not going to go away completely. It'll come back in some other more, maybe more extreme form, right?
Right. And it almost seems, obviously as an adult, the more you're on this path and doing the daily practice and trying to work on stuff, you can work on your catalysis pretty quickly, or soon after it occurs. But I think it's almost like, it seems like this reality is set up that it's understandable that a lot of childhood catalyst is not going to be dealt with in the child because it's just too hard. Dealing with it as an adult, right?
Right. You need a character to be able to work with this stuff. And until you've built that character, that actionable third density entity, you have no way of like testing whether or not you met the mark or not when you make these changes. So a lot of what adult life is looking back at what made us who we are to this date, and then kind of slowly and carefully and tenderly sort of unknotting the threads, right? Sort of seeing what was going on and, oh, I got scolded or I got, you know, beat up or something, but I didn't deserve that. And I don't need to be afraid of it just because I don't like it, because
right.
I survived. I'm still here. I'm still in a position to redeem and integrate these experiences. Remember that catalyst is most aptly a feature of the subconscious bringing some sort of like projection into our conscious awareness. It comes at us from sideways. It doesn't come to us straight ahead. So it takes some work to kind of put this stuff back together. But I want to say that this work of balancing catalyst and like working with it, it's like we think that it's about these discrete events, you know, something that happened in your childhood or something that happened to you at work or something like that. But I want to say that these events are symbols of deeper energetic expressions of ourself that we are forming we're forming a relation to in the unique ways that we do. And it's these unique ways that we form relations to the very stuff that everyone else has to deal with, because all is one. So it's all really one event. But in the way that we work with it in separation, we allow for a unique relationship that no other mind-body-spirit complex has to come into clear view.
Yeah, absolutely. And one way to think about it that I think is very concrete is think about when – so I would have – so just to rephrase what you're saying, I absolutely agree that even the stuff that happens in childhood, it's because the energetic potentiality was already there, and that external projection solidified that as a catalyst for you to work upon, right? And ultimately the whole purpose is to work upon it so that you can achieve an energetic balance from the original energetic potentiality that was maybe a bit imbalanced that brought about this entire catalyst.
The illusion gives us a handle on it. The illusion gives us a handle on it, where otherwise it might be too abstract, you know?
And one way to think about it is that when you have an issue, right, and you've recognized it's an issue, but you recognize maybe you're still working through it and you haven't, and you know you have a lot more work to do, right? This is often true for big childhood catalysts. Even if you understand it and you've done therapy, you've done the spiritual work, it takes months, years, right, to kind of chip away and to get all of the little lessons involved to really balance it. It takes time, right? And when you're in the process, you might be aware that it's the healing or the balancing is not yet complete. And you'll have interactions with other people, and you'll actually, if you're at a level of self-awareness, which I think I'd like to think most of our viewers are, where someone will say something and you'll get triggered by it. And you'll recognize either maybe in the moment or maybe during your daily meditation, it wasn't what the person said that actually bothered me directly. It triggered my earlier trauma, right? I think we always recognize that. Well, in a certain sense, if we are infinite beings, which we are, right, who go through numerous incarnations, whatever happened in your childhood, that energetic potential was there, right? Sometimes for early childhood stuff, even before you're born. So it's not, the external event is just a projection of that.
Bingo. Right? Yes. So. That's what I was trying to say. In the same way that in a dream, the dream events are symbols of deeper things that otherwise would be, it almost seems like otherwise it would be impossible to convey to the conscious mind.
Right.
So and it gives you a handle on it. And then through interpretation and reflection and meditation, right, you have some entry to working on it.
Now, of course, we can criticize or question why reality is set up this way. But because we have the veil of forgetting between incarnations, because our dreams, there's a forced symbolism, I would like to call it, because I've tried in so many lucid dreams to just be like, hey, just be literal with me. And they're like, we can't. That's against the rules, basically. But because of those dynamics, we're not easily able to see necessarily the projection. But once you start doing the work, once you start examining these concepts at a deeper level, you'll start to see the patterns that it is truly a projection and it wasn't caused by this incident.
Right. And the degree to which it takes work to uncover and piece back together that message, I have found that's the degree to which it is a truly foundational learning that you're doing. The harder it is, the more it's needed, right? Like, and we are working back to the source. All of these things that we have cast out of ourselves and projected, they all get pulled back in. And I think one of the things that Kuo talked about pretty frequently throughout the archive is the sense in which fourth density influx of love and light is causing these projections and repressions to manifest in starker and starker forms. In Tilting at Windmills, the book that Gary Bean wrote on interviewing Carla and Jim not too long ago, Carla talks about this and says, I think the thing that has changed, that has really shifted, is that I see a lot more difficulty that people are running into now. And that's because there's more truth. There's more light. That shift has happened and people are receiving fourth density light a lot. In fourth density, you have only to ask a little bit and you'll get such an answer. You don't want it to be you. You don't want to work with the shadow self. No, that's not me. But it is. But then you have to do the work. If you can do the work, sit down and find that part of yourself that was so much in pain that you buried that shadow side. Dig it up and take a look and see what all needs to be done to heal it. And then go about integrating it into your light side. And that has to be done whenever you see the work to do. We're never quite finished with that. I think that it's important to understand that as a seeker, you are not perfect and there's no requirement for you to be completely balanced to the point of total equanimity, never having any emotional reactions or never reacting to triggering or anything like that. These are all plot points in the overall story. They serve a purpose. And just because we have this sort of linear idea that they are problems to be solved, and maybe that there's some usefulness to that focus, doesn't mean that, you know, they don't have a goodness to them, that they aren't here ultimately to help us in this linear process that we are perceiving of how we return to the Creator.
Absolutely. You know, one thing I think that happens if you focus too much on the perception of being spiritually evolved, right? Like not reacting, not triggering. Like, I think it is true that when you've been doing the personal work for years on end, naturally, you know, you'll have fewer triggers. But I think if you over-focus on, let me just not react in the moment. And obviously, if you're going to say something really crazy and hurtful, or do something really crazy and hurtful, sure, go ahead and repress it. I 100% approve of it. Or if you're in a situation where you're due to your workplace, you're not allowed to express yourself, you know, maybe in the moment, you know, take stock and use some repression, but, you know, make a plan of action to revisit it in meditation later that day. But I do think that if you focus on your immediate reaction, the outer manifestations of the cat, of how, what you're feeling, it sidetracks you, because you might get really good at that and you might not actually address the underlying triggers, right? So it's
but how do you address, wait a minute, how do you address the triggers without feeling the feeling as it is?
Right. But what I'm saying is if you just get really good at not reacting in the moment, you might not actually address the underlying triggers, right?
I see.
So it's
saying,
really important to address the underlying triggers, do the spiritual work, you know, strengthen that spiritual muscle. And then you'll see over time, naturally, you'll get less triggered. But the goal isn't necessarily to get less triggered.
Bingo.
I mean, maybe that's initially the motivation to start the stuff. But if you really want to understand and be on the path and really excel in the path, you'll start to understand the deeper dynamics involved, where it's really about the inner work and not necessarily rushing towards looking like you're a saintly person on the outside, right? Parts of that will come in time or may never come in time, right? But the point is, it's not about appearances. It's more about organic, deep inner work.
Yeah, yeah. And we were talking before the recording about the sense in which I've been thinking about the message of Monka to the Richmond group the last 3 times that they've spoken to us. And they keep talking about this idea of mirroring without and mirroring within. If an outer situation doesn't allow you to work with it, you can always bring it within and work on it, and vice versa. If you can't work something out inside of yourself, reality will manifest a kind of symbolic handle for you to get clear on it. And I've been thinking about that introjective part. So like the part where you're working through your lessons in the outer world would be projection, right? You're projecting these unconscious hidden parts of yourself that end up being reflected in others' patterns, others' habits and actions. But there's a difference between repressing something in a way that pushes it down outside of you and what I'm thinking of as introjection, where you're instead using the fact that you have many selves within yourself as a way to project the issue into yourself and work with that. And that is different than simply trying to get it out of the way. It's really trying to bring it into the heart and sort of work with it and understand its character. Because when we want to repress things about ourselves, I think there's a sense in which we literally do not want to know them at all. It's not that we are absolutely certain how bad it is, and that's why we're repressing it necessarily. It's that we don't want to know how bad it is. We don't even want to think about it. We don't want to get there's a sense in which, like, you know, when we take away the attention from it so completely, we do in a sense make it unreal, at least temporarily. Whereas like if we're worrying about it, or if we're like ashamed of it and it's like in the back of our head working on it, at least we're still working on it, right? It may not be good work, but at least we have a handle on it. We haven't lost it. The real trouble with repression is that when things bubble back up, they will be in a way that will seem to be unrelated, will seem to be completely orthogonal to the direction we thought the repression was going. And yet that's exactly why they present in these ways, because they're giving us a new flavor that we can work with it anew, rather than working. It's an opportunity to break our pattern of working with it in one way and do some other way, because it appears to present differently, right?
Exactly. So can you give an example? And because I think I have some examples, but that concept of basically where you are working with, I forget the phrase you use, but the opposite of projection, where you're basically, introjection?
Introjection, yeah.
Yeah. So can you give me an example? Because I already feel like what you described, I think I have maybe examples of that. You know, it's very much a thing. It sounds like it's you do in personal work, right?
Well,
it's,
yeah, it would have to be, right? Because it's in the self. Right. But the point is that, you know, the sense I'm getting is that the level at which we have conscious awareness is kind of like one band of an overall self that has a center. So we're either going infinitely towards the center or infinitely out away from the center. Both of those are really the same kind of thing. And so what introjection would be kind of like taking it within in meditation and sort of recognizing it in the pantheon of selves that we work with that are so fragmented within ourselves, because largely we need to fragment them. We need to be a certain self at a certain time. I'm not going to bring my dancing at a jungle show for a DJ self to the bank when I need a loan, right? Like those are different selves, and we can see it as the positive way of looking at it is, oh, I just projected a different self. I don't hate the other self that I didn't project. I just, it wasn't appropriate. And that is maybe you could see as a healthy way of understanding the multiplicity of expressions that of cells in within you that need expression, and then judiciously working with it to express it, to give it expression, but also not to give it full license to take over. Right.
So would an example of introjection be perhaps like, so this is something I've done. You know, you'll be watching.
I think dreaming is interjection.
Okay. Right?
It's like we always work out things in our dreams that have some relationship mm-hmm. to our outer lives, right? Another way would be like working with things in meditation, right?
Right.
So like it's there that we have the space and the patience to not just accept our first reaction to something within us, but instead to work with it. The problem with repression is that it's purposely put the issue beyond your ability to grasp it. With introjection, what you're trying to do is take responsibility for it so that you can grasp it. Maybe you can't work with it to completion this time. That's okay. It's not about a single act of relating. It's about building a relationship over time. None of this stuff is going to happen immediately. You are, by definition, as a seeker, committing yourself to a long-running, ongoing task of opening yourself to yourself slowly and carefully. Because if you do it too quickly, like, yeah, that is dangerous. That is, to give full expression to all of your energies without having a relationship with them, that is one of safety and common purpose.
So can you walk me through an example of interjecting during your personal work and how you kind of how it helped you?
Well, it's still something that I'm working on, the idea of. I'm trying to figure out what it is that Mönche is trying to tell us. So this is all just a guess, and it could change. But I think, like, let's say at work, I ask for a raise and I'm denied. And that causes some frustration in me because, you know, I think I deserve it, or the company has money, or, you know, whatever. That frustration is something that could come out as anger towards my boss or whatever, right? That's one possible way to take the tension that the situation has catalytically created in me and give it and release that energy so that I can, because the point of releasing the energy, whether it's mm-hmm. in projection or introduction, is to know it, it's through experience that we know it. Otherwise, it is this unknown. And a lot of times we're repressing things we don't wish to know, because knowing them means kind of experiencing them. And then our whole selves are wrapped up in it. Our whole selves are already wrapped up in it, but we do it in this consciously aware way. So I could take that anger into myself, much like Ra talks about with the balancing practice, right? Like, daily life can be seen as a balancing exercise of a sort, right?
Absolutely.
It's just not one that we feel like we are directing. With introjection, and when you repress, you're also doing it too, but you're doing it in a way that's putting it outside of your agency, because you're shuttling it back to the unconscious. And by definition, the unconscious is something that we don't have this immediate direct access to. So with introjection, what you're doing is you're trying to take responsibility for the fact that the outer world has not given you sufficient means to work with it. And therefore, you take it in and work with it on your own terms through balancing, where you exacerbate the feeling, and then you exacerbate it. You let the opposite come into your consciousness. You exacerbate that, and then you accept yourself for having both of these.
Right.
That way, like, one immediate thing that gives you is it takes the power of the knee-jerk reaction of rejection of self away. Now it doesn't feel like that's necessary anymore, because I have a way to relate to it beyond just getting rid of it. I've given myself this possibility. And like, that's what I mean by we don't know these things that we repress, because we don't want to know them. Like, there has to be this growth within ourselves that we become willing to work with these things. And often that there's great pain and great soul searching involved in that. And then at some point you realize I either do this work or I stay where I'm at.
Right. So I totally agree. And I love the term introjection. And so I think one thing to keep in mind as we're discussing this is that the nature of the shadow self and projection, right, which are two concepts, you know, that have been discussed at length in some way in the Confederation material. It's clear that there's very core to third density experience and even fourth density experience. So it makes sense that the opposite concept or the associated concept, sister concept to projection, and we called it introduction, is also going to be a very fundamental concept. So whatever we're describing here, it's going to be something that those on the spiritual path have all done, right? So I absolutely agree. So what you're describing is introjection. You know, I've referred to it as basically understanding that all catalysts are the triggers are internal, right? I think I've talked about it in a way of characterizing as taking personal emotional responsibility instead of blaming externally what happened, but to look inward with what exactly about the situation bothered you, right? And once again, just to reiterate, the outcome of these exercises is certainly balance, but often the outcome of these exercises, even once you achieve balance, is not inaction, right? Like, let's say, for example, this is just pure speculation. So if Jeremy's employer is watching, please, this is completely speculation. Let's say Jeremy asked for that raise, right? And he's denied. Initially, it's very natural to get pissed off, but during the daily work, he revisits it and he realizes deep down after balancing everything and he feels clear. Ultimately, the reason he was truly upset was at a deep level, he hates his current job. He just doesn't like it. And that's why he was so frustrated, even though it wasn't readily apparent. Because, right, that sort of realization sometimes is deeper in your subconscious, right? And so often, even after you're balanced, you'll take action, right? So often at the end of these balancing techniques, it's not becoming what I would call like I forget the phrase, but is it a stone Buddha? It's like where you're just sitting immobile and you're just, look, maybe you'll get to that level at some stage, but the organic day-to-day practice of doing these balancing techniques, you'll often come to a balanced state that results in another form of action, right? As you realize truly what's going on. You're mute.
That's because I was typing so much. On the subject of balance, I have, I think, a good quote to read from a Kuo session, February 10th, 2002. And Kuo says, "When one is talking about balance, one must talk without making generalities, for no two people have the same balance. Each entity will have a different kind of chakra system, a different way of using it, a different way of expressing it, letting it go, and moving it through the body. No two entities are at all alike. They may harmonize, and then they are perceived as aura enhancers, or they may tend not to harmonize. Upon the level that balance is achieved without dealing with the light and the dark, what is best is simply to come into loving relationship with the pattern as a whole, so that you celebrate the dirt, the muck, the seeming darkness with honest and sincere appreciation, just as you have appreciation for fertilizers and fields and for the cleanliness of a cleaned out system that would be toxic if one were not able to process food and remove it through the bowel. The perceived darkness of things is negative, and those who honestly believe that the heart is a false creator will attempt again and again to use only light in order to achieve truth. The problem is that there is no balance in light that does not have love within it. Without love, the light shall always bend itself into service to self. For without the heart, there is no clearinghouse to take what this instrument would call the 90-degree shift from one type of energy to another. And this is what each is attempting to see, that shift in consciousness that is beyond doing well at perceived tasks or finding better ways to do tasks. What is actually the benefit and the service of the entity is far below that level, far below what an entity is aware that she is offering. It is in the being of the entity, the way that the entity responds in a spontaneous and free manner to the present moment with those with whom she comes into contact, with those of whom she thinks, with those prayers which she occupies her mind, and with those hopes and dreams that she holds dear and moves to in thought to create places of light in the spirit world. That is the self that entities actually respond to, that they take fire from, and that without knowing why they feel as the light upon the hill that shines forth and radiates in a way that is beyond them and expresses spirit. It is not the entity that is skillful at directing the life. It is the entity who loves in and out of season that is truly serving. So where a balance is an excellent thing to seek, and this is addressing what you're saying, Nathan. So where balance is an excellent thing to seek, it is not necessarily a goal, because it is yet another thing about which to have a preference. It is yet another trap to lay for oneself to say that if I have balance, if I have equanimity, then I am wise. True balance involves the knowledge that no one knows anything, and that includes the self. Even the one known as St. Paul the Apostle said that, "I am the least of all Christians." Even arrogance must at last, when speaking upon the level of the soul, own its humility and accept the imperfection of this entire experience. I think that's maybe a good place to stop. But I think it's important to see that this balance is an ongoing affair. It's not just something you do and then you're done with it. That is a way, but it's important because it seems like the subjects of these balances, these balancing moments, are discrete. They're these events, they're these feelings. You do, and it seems straight ahead. They present themselves. You balance them. You move on, and it just that is like a good way to think about it in terms of directing your energies in the moment by moment balancing of catalyst. But it's not a goal, because then you'll never be there, right? You're never going to be done with it.
Yeah. And I think I think anyone who's kind of been on this path recognizes that it's a journey. It can be a little confusing when you start this journey, because when you start this journey, I think, you know, the first few times you have insight, there's new states of balance achieved. It releases a sense of energetic euphoria, and that can last for like weeks to months, frankly. Yeah. And it can be confusing because you can mistake that, frankly, temporary sense of euphoria for, oh, this is the new heightened state of balance. And then once you keep on doing the work for years, you'll notice you'll have moments like that, but ultimately they're temporary, and that there might be a gradual increase in over time of balance, but it's not like, oh, I'm suddenly enlightened. You might have flashes of insight, and you'll definitely have moments in meditation where you feel, you know, you understand it all, but maybe it's because the veil, or, you know, just the human mind can't constantly keep that sort of realization. It's because it's a realization of infinity front and center all the time. But basically it's a constant journey, and it's a journey of faith, because so many of these times, as you get more and more into the subtle balancing of a situation, it's hard to actually know, like, it doesn't always feel like there's some great realization, right? And it's sometimes you feel like, am I just like, treading water? Like, what's going on? And you have to have faith that there is a method to the madness, even if you don't understand it, right? Third density is not a density of understanding how reality works. And so you have to often find different motivations other than truly understanding how reality works. One great motivation I find, I think for a lot of people, the motivation is often healing, right? But as you become more and more sophisticated, because people will often be able to heal themselves to a significant degree, you know, once they start doing this work. And often the desire or intent to do this from a place of to be healed decreases. So you often have to have other motivations, right? So for me, it's often a sense of curiosity and self-discovery, but what the true self is.
Bingo.
That motivates you to keep doing it.
That's what I was going to bring up when you were done speaking. That it's this, yeah. It becomes less this, oh, now I got to work on this issue with myself. And right. More like, what is it about this that really bugs me? Mm-hmm. Like it's a curiosity and a desire to explore, to know the self. Like, honestly, at the end of the day, as long as we don't want to know ourselves, these things are going to be repressed. So it is, and they talk in some other session about how it's actually in the same session. We urge people over and over again to refine their desires, Guo says. We urge them to seek the silence and to ask within the silence for the further refining of truth, for the further honing of the desire to know. This is because this is the path that yields to the seeker those abilities to move from the world of black and white into the world of moving energy, energy that passes through all the chakras, moving up and through and out, catalyst moving down and through and out in a majestic mixture of inner planes and outer planes function, in which the human physical vehicle is an inextricable and valuable part of spiritual growth and the great sender of signals of that which is your mind, your body, and your spirit. And the person in charge of sending each signal to the mind, which sends to the body, and which shares with the spirit, is that perception that is believed to have occurred. What is that faith which each of you holds, to which each of you can cling? Where are there simple and easy ground rules for improving one's perception of these things? This instrument has found helpful and uses to this day the following prayer. Lord, make us instruments of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let us sow love. Where there is injury, pardon. Where there is discord, union. Where there is doubt, faith. Where there is despair, hope. Where there is darkness, light. Where there is sadness, joy. O divine master, teach us to seek not so much to be loved as to love, to be understood as to understand, to be consoled as to console. For it is in pardoning that we are pardoned, it is in giving that we receive, and it is in dying that we rise to eternal life. This is a prayer of light and dark, and of the choices that we make in the way we feel. Entities surrounding one shall predictably offer one negative catalyst. Catalyst that is perceived to be negative because it is dealing with other people's projections of one's own dark side, which is another way of saying that you are projections of their dark side, and that all entities are busy demonstrating the humanity of the self to the other self. Each of you is valuable in that regard, if in no other, for all of you are a bad example from time to time. And blessed are the bad examples as well as the good examples. Blessed are those moments when you despair and think that I will never get this problem. Because at that point that you realize that there is a bad attitude that is involved here, blessed is each moment when you are able to pinpoint anything about the thinking process with which you might quarrel. For these are the things which can be improved by watching the thoughts one has and the comments that one makes to oneself about these thoughts. There truly are voices within the mind that need to be put into deep memory, into deep storage, into files that are closed, that do need to remain in the voices that speak in dreams and in the voices that speak within the musing of inner thoughts. The voices that are needed are the voices of silence, not our words, not the words of your parents, not the words of any perceived guardian or authority can give you that which is beyond words. The presence of the one infinite creator whose nature is absolute love. I'm just reading super extended passages, but it's really difficult to find succinct passages in the material, because whenever the shadow self is being dealt with, you are dealing with the full complexity of the human situation. It's the thing that keeps people coming to sessions and asking Kuo questions. It's the thing that keeps me asking Kuo questions and asking myself questions about how do I relate to all of this stuff? And I think a lot of the way that you relate to it is you recognize how illusory it is, and therefore it's as safe to work with as a dream is. Because what makes the dream poignant and powerful are those things that you need out of it. And the way that it presents that is just a means. It's not the full thing that you are trying to express to yourself through this process of projection or dreaming or whatever. And that faith that this is all part of a process in which you are usefully and engaged in something that's good for you. That's I think where you really have to cling. You have to realize that I didn't choose any of this consciously. In terms of like being born, like I'm sure part of me did choose to be born, but I don't participate in that part of me that made that choice. So I have to have faith that there are things beyond my ken that are working positively with me for the benefit of me and for the benefit of the creation. Is that something that waking reality will evince to you immediately? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And so that's why it's faith. That's why it is it's trying to find a way in which spiritually you can plant your feet on solid ground. And therefore you have a reference point by which to evaluate all these things happening. It's only when you feel you have some sort of like place of stability that you can start to evaluate these things that seem other than you. And instead of you being floating in space and they're just floating in space and you have no way of like orienting, once you have faith, you have made a commitment to ground yourself on certain principles. And then everything else that seems other can be evaluated in relation to those principles. This is why Carla would often talk about, I think, having a rule of life. It's not because the rule will tell you everything that you need to know about each and every situation. It's that it gives you the ability to start recognizing the underlying vibration that rule is imperfectly sort of codifying and making a little bit too concrete. But it's useful until you can feel into that vibration that comes from spirit. Once you have that, you don't necessarily need the rule anymore, because your spontaneous actions will evince and reflect the balance that you've received, the balance that you've achieved. Am I making any sense?
Yeah. For some reason, I was just thinking about how difficult it is to arrive at faith from a purely intellectual perspective if you haven't done the personal work, if you haven't explored these things. It's so difficult.
I don't think you can arrive at faith intellectually at all. It's the counter intellectual moment par excellence. It's the point at which you say, like Kuo said, I don't understand any of this. My ability to serve the creator and through that serve myself and those that I love and those I care about comes from recognizing that I don't understand anything, and therefore being fluid and open to these things instead of having these set reactions. These reactions that I have intuitively created in order to protect me from what I think the reality will show me. Because usually, I've seen this over and over in myself, facing dark parts of myself. When I actually face them, they're not as bad as I think they
are. Yeah, absolutely.
It's the fact that I don't want to deal with it and I've built them up into boogeymen that makes them so scary.
It builds like an energetic field of fear around it for some reason.
Yes, and it reminds me of how the Confederation had said that like worry is negative desire. Like when you worry about something, it's like equivalent to desiring it. It's just, it has this other valence to it. But it still attracts.
I, yeah, that's a great point. maybe we can even do a whole episode on that, because this is so the concept of like worry as a sort of fear. It's I feel like I've gotten a lot of pushback from people even who have done not necessarily work as it relates to Confederation or fault Confederation philosophy, but a lot of people I feel like they have trouble understanding that you can take the same action without operating from a place of fear or concern or worry. Like, you don't have to fear getting into a car accident to wear your seatbelt. Like, I don't get in the car and be like, oh, I need to put on my seatbelt because I'm going to die. Like, there's no sense of fear. It just, you can do a lot of things without having fear or worry. And so the concept that fear is really just like, it's kind of like a negative desire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely like agree with the point of attention in a sense appears to me to effect traction upon those projections that we have seemingly illusorily separated from ourselves. So when we give it attention, we then take something that we have thrown away from ourselves, and we then have this new relation to it that comes from us being aware of it. Now, right. Something that we tried to expurgate from our awareness is now suddenly in our awareness, but in this new positionally right. different way, right?
And it's very key to understand that even though we have a new relationship to the worry, like we see it, we understand it as a form of negative desire, sense of control. Mm-hmm. It doesn't immediately evaporate. You're still going to have worry and concern, but you'll relate to it in a different way. And, you know, you'll begin to, once again, this is not the goal. It's more about the self-discovery of who you are as a loving infinite being, you know, that's in unity with everything that is all. But the sense of power and the immediacy of that fear and concern will start to diminish as you do the personal work, right?
And I think one other element to bring up about this fear of these things that we don't want to face is that often, I think probably all the time, what we fear because it has power.
Absolutely.
And when we reject parts of ourselves that are powerful, they tend to manifest that power in oblique ways that catch us off guard. Carla, through Kuo, Carla would often talk about the wolf within us, right? The murderer, the rapist, the thief, all of those things that we see.
You want to throw in the pedophile?
Not particularly, but hey.
I'm just saying, I mean, these are
what are you trying to say? No.
Yeah, there's nothing specific to anyone here, obviously. I do criminal defense, so I have to deal with these cases.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, just because we recognize these things as part of the whole and in some sense part of us, it doesn't mean that we feel that it's immediately going to remove the fear and comfort and the sting of going into these areas, right? These are still hard things to work with, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe this would be a good session to quote from on this topic. This is September 17th, 2006. It's towards the bottom of our document, Nathan. Kuo says, as you begin to settle into a fearless attitude towards the incoming vibrations from fourth density and the many waves of energy that are hastening the process, shall we say, or helping it mature appropriately for what this instrument knows as from what this instrument knows as the central sun, there are increasing probabilities that for each entity, the experiences that are to come will be substantial. They will not necessarily be heavy, for heaviness depends on how you emotionally react to the incoming catalyst. However, the nature of the fourth density energies is one of the most transparent honesty and truth. Under the light of this energy, or shall we say under the influence of this energy, that which is within the mind and has been shut away as unworthy or undesirable shall move from the shadowed recesses of that inner closet into outer manifestation. There will be a situation in your life, or a person in your life, or just an inner thought process that will show you the shape and the basic feeling that you have about this hidden part of yourself. That's the key to understanding how to work with these incoming energies. Resistance, as this instrument remembers the Borg saying many times in Star Trek, is useless. These energies have an intended effect of helping individuals who are attempting to awaken to see the shape, the texture, the odor, and the nature of those parts of the shadow self that have not yet been recruited to be a part of your round table of white knights. Keep that in mind. Recruited. Remember that knighthood is that which is attained by warriors. In working with these energies, see yourselves as warriors for light and truth. Let yourself become fierce. Do not be afraid to gaze at the murderer within, the liar within, the adulterer within, the lazy person within, or whatever other distortion hits your attention with all of the power of a harsh wind or a severe rain. Stand in the wind, glory in the wind, blah, glory in the rain, and give thanks. When you are giving thanks for this catalyst, you are releasing yourself from pride. You are releasing from yourself pride and pretension. You are emptying your mental pockets of all of the tools that you have in the everyday world that are supposed to fix things. You empty yourself of these tools because that which is hitting you is not to be dealt with from the level of third density. It is to be dealt with from the level of fourth density. There is no concern as to what this means, my friends, for you have heard it many, many times in different ways. You are love. You are light. You are all that there is. You are not going anywhere. You are never at risk. When you begin to get a sense of the eternal and infinite nature of your soul stream, and when you realize that you are here at this time specifically to be hit with this truth and this shining light, that realization may help you to firm up your determination to take advantage of this opportunity. You are not responsible for what you see coming in. Your area of responsibility is in how you respond. This is not a call to martyrdom, my friends, but rather it is a call to ethical behavior. It is an encouragement to make of life a spiritual, sacred game in which you attempt to move yourself from the still point where you neither love others greatly or yourself greatly. We encourage you to make a choice. If you wish to polarize in service to others, start gazing at others with the realization that you are here to help them, just as they are here to help you. Open your minds to the creative question of what seed might you plant that may be helpful.
Well said, and I just want to repeat one of the sentences you read. Do not be afraid to gaze at the murderer within, the liar within, the adulterer within, the lazy person within, or whatever other distortion hits your attention with all the power of a harsh wind or a severe rain. That's really hard to do, and part of what that means to me, part of it is when you're ready to go there, is truly putting yourselves in the shoes of that person, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a news article you read. Maybe it's someone you know in real life, you've interacted with in real life. And what you'll find is you'll have certain facts that will help you begin to understand the person, why they did, right? Maybe they grew up on the streets, homeless, and that's why they became a murderer. And, or maybe it's not just that, right? Because there's always an element of free will. But maybe on top of that, what triggered the murder was someone else being exceptionally rude to their face. Not that there's a defense. But it's interesting in that when you start to put yourself in their shoes and understand these heinous things, murder, rape, adultery, you know, lying, at a very deep level, if you are willing to do that thought experiment, put yourself in their shoes, what you'll find is you'll actually be able to, in a certain sense, because you've confronted it, not only balance and accept it, which doesn't mean inaction, but because you've able to examine it, what you'll find is you'll actually end up not just be able to understand the factors that took place, but then you'll, because you understand the situation that maybe create the propensity for this sort of behavior, you're actually, in a strange sense, better able to not only prevent yourself if you feel you have resonance with murdering or whatever, but not just that, but also your interaction with others will be subtly changed. Like, because of my work in criminal defense, I now see how, because there's so much mental health, so much substance abuse, so much pain in people's lives, I see how just being rude to someone who is, like, say, let's say, cutting in line at the DMV, you know, I'm not saying don't say anything, but be mindful how, and I've literally seen cases like this, how just even a righteous comment to the person who's cutting in line and being rude to them can trigger the murder within them. So in a certain sense, understanding these things at a deep level, putting yourselves in their shoes, actually helps you create a reality where these things are less likely to occur, not just within yourself, but also within others. So it's not just a thing that you that is for spiritual growth internally, although that's the most important part. But when you do this deep work, it's, you know, they often say the inner work reflects in the outer reality. And sometimes it happens in mysterious ways, but sometimes it also happens in very organic, understandable ways. And this is one of those ways where the more you work with seeing people who have done heinous things, the more you understand that sometimes just being kind to someone when you have no reason to be kind to them can change the entire course of their day, you know?
Yeah. And when somebody first encounters that idea, the normal immediate thought is, okay, well then I'm going to do the things that change the day, that change the situation for good. And I'm just going to do that. And through that, I'm going to have control of the situation and I'm going to be able to make it conform to my will. And that's usually when you get smacked upside the head, right? The point is that we have a choice on how we react to these things, but we don't have a choice on how other people react to our reactions. Mm-hmm. So we have to release the idea that we have any control over this. And instead, but like, isn't that very similar to the way that we relate to those parts of ourselves that we've repressed? Because by repressing them, we have explicitly placed them outside of our control in any way of relating at all. At least that person who is threatening us outside ourselves is addressable. Mm-hmm. And can be related to. if we've pushed something so far down that we don't even have the ability to access it, then we really are lost to it. And it's really just about, I think what you're saying is that, like, if you put yourself in their shoes, you recognize that whatever it is that seems so separate about them will kind of dissolve a little bit. And it's often Absolutely. A very humbling thing. I know I'm reading a lot of long passages, but may I take another crack?
Yeah, let's go right into it.
This is one of my favorites. It's December 21st, 2003. Kuo says, "It is as though there are parts of the self that have been denied because they are too dark. They are too seemingly selfish or evil or harsh or rough. And yet that whole entity which you are cannot function without all, both the light and the dark of its nature. Many times, entities who polarize towards beauty and truth and purity feel that they must deny and leave behind those shadow portions of the self. And yet we would ask you not to leave behind one iota of that 360 degrees of self that you do possess. For all of the voices within you, all of the 180 degrees of good and 180 degrees of that which you label not good, are necessary to integrate into one peaceful kingdom within. Many are the times that this instrument has asked the question, what is peace? For she meditates on behalf of peace each night. And one of the keys to understanding peace, the concept of peace as a living thing and not as a dead idea, is to realize that peace is the complete and harmonious integration of light and dark so that all is in balance within the whole entity and all of that entity's faculties are brought to bear on a situation. Not simply those faculties towards the good, but those faculties that might be considered towards the negative. For the thief, the coveter, the lazy one, all of those dark voices within can be charmed into becoming the bedrock of will that puts grit into the expression of love, that the light part of the self has no trouble expressing. Yet when the going gets rough, it is that dark side of the self that is able to take hold in difficult situations and endure. That same darkness could be the wolf that bites, then, has become the best support possible for the light. And this is the hoped-for result of an incarnation full of both the light and the dark, as the seasons revolve and as the seasons of inner life revolve as well." This whole idea of the wolf inside of us that comes out in these nasty ways, right? Ways that we would not choose. The idea is not to lock it up or push it down or chain it, but instead to form this relationship with it. And this is a very important part that had a big impact on my spiritual path. When those of Kuo talk about how a lot of your grit and determination and strength comes from this wolf, when we repress these negative parts of ourself without taking a relation to them that is loving, we thereby we experience the power in ways that we have absolutely no say over. By having a relationship to it, we start to recruit this negativity and let it work in tandem with our whole self. And then what we find is that a lot of those things that seem negative have a way of working with our positive goals. Just as I'm sure many of the things that we consider to be positive service to others do have some utility to a service to self person. They just have to Absolutely. Be used in the right way.
There are going to be parts of the shadow self, you know, that this quote talks about, that are going to be more refined in some, like maybe not more refined, but I mean, they talk about this in general, right? Ra talks about this in general, that generally speaking, service self entities work more with the red, orange, and yellow rays and don't work with, you know, the green and blue. And obviously, sometimes the way, or often the way they interact with those chakras is going to be inconsistent with positive service to others, but not 100% of the time. There are some areas of commonality, right? So specifically, Ra talks about that, for example, the service self entity, while it does have a closed green ray, it does the portion of the green ray that's open, the small portion that's open, because if the ray is completely closed, the entity is dead. The portion of the green ray that's open in a service self entity is compassion towards itself, green ray compassion towards itself, which is unconditional. It's different than the orange ray, which is a little bit more grounded, whereas the green ray compassion to the self, unconditional compassion to the self, is more of a spiritual nature. Right. So you gotta look on your face.
I'm not sure what I think about that. But I think I see where you're going, actually. To me, the idea of a service to self entity having anything unconditionally other than their own appetites and desires. Right. So like the point is, so in the service to others, the green ray unconditional love is ideally extended to the entire self.
Right. Unconditional is a bad word because it's clearly conditional. It's only directed towards the self.
I don't think it's necessarily bad, but it's the idea is that the unconditionality in service to self is given to only one small part of the self that then is in domination of the rest of the self.
Of the rest of the self. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Agreed. So, no, I mean, so, for example, I think, you know, I don't know if you follow Mike Tyson, but he's on a lot of podcasts, and I don't totally follow him, but he shows up on Instagram feed, and he's actually, by the way, he's done a lot of personal work, and it's very clear. He actually has a lot of spiritual and wise comments. He really has. And there's this one interview, and this is in relation to what we're just talking about, the wolf, right? That there is, that you might repress the wolf as being dark, but there's going to be... there are some aspects of it that can be useful. So Mike Tyson is being interviewed recently about, you know, his time as a fighter, as a boxer, how he liked that. And there's more than one interview on this. And if you look at a lot of his interviews, he has a lot of mixed feelings. But in this one particular interview, he talks about how, you know, he hated that person. The person who was a boxer, and he's like, yeah. And then it's actually William Shatner, who's interviewing him. He's like, you hated that person. And he's like, so you hated fighting? He's like, no. I loved the actual fighting, but I hated who I became in order to become that good fighter. Mm-hmm. I hated all, because he's like, I used, you know, anger and frustration and rage. And I forget the emotions, but he's like, That's what came with that being that fighter. And I didn't like all those things. You know, I didn't like those things. So obviously though, you know, whenever you do something and you're the best at it, there's going to be willpower, right? There's going to be a bunch of concepts used that are not necessarily negative, right? Just because you're the best at something doesn't mean you're using negative philosophy to get there, right? It might be more consistent with negative philosophy because negatives try to establish an elite. But it's not always the case that just because you have some sort of energetic configuration that allows you to achieve something, that it's 100% negative, right? There's going to be some aspects. It's really, in a certain sense, is just what they're saying, is that you can learn, you can actually learn positive lessons from negative sides of your shadow self, from negative entities that you see elsewhere, right? Because honestly, negative entities have a great sense of discipline that, yes, some of it is going to be motivated by control and not through acceptance, but there's still aspects that are going to be consistent with an accepting service to others philosophy that you can learn. I'm not saying follow a negative entity, but I'm just saying is there's value in creation to these experiences.
Just because they put too much sugar in the cake doesn't mean you have to put too much sugar in the cake. You can put just enough sugar, you know, like
right.
You can see, because there's like this way in which a lot of what polarization does is it makes us act in absolutes. And it is those absolutes that show us the potential. But then we have to sort of figure out what mixture we're going to take that absolute and actually condense it and use just enough to make this recipe that we're calling the self that we want to be. What was I going to say? I want to read another passage. I'm not sure if it's related, but
let's go there.
March 10th, 1996, Kuo says, "As the process of graduation from third density continues, each shall walk the stairs of light with each its own dark side firmly integrated into that self which walks for eternity. Therefore, the paradox that is the sign of all spiritual truth is laid bare. The challenge is so to acknowledge, accept, and balance the shadow self that the total being is ready to gaze into that light which blesses fourth density existence, for you can leave not one whit of self behind. Now, how can this be done? How can that blackness within, which expresses within the self in ways of hurt and pain, ever be a part of the love and light of the one infinite creator? Each entity walks upon two legs. When the spirit finds its legs, one is light, one is the dark. Together they make one holograph which is identical to the infinite creator. The shadow self is to be related to then as one of the two legs which cause the spirit to stand within the illusion in which each finds itself. One relates to the shadow self as to the musculature, the connective tissue, the power and the strength which enable the spiritual seeker to stand fast through times of difficulty and woe. The shadow that seems so heavy and dark is also that which grounds and sustains and makes secure. The will is part of the shadow self. This will animates, informs, and vivifies those ideals, hopes, and dreams, which the light portion of being so loves to dream. The shadow side is that which persists until all has been accomplished." I think that puts it in good terms. There was another session that we were involved in that talked about this in an interesting way. And it has to do with November 5th, 2023, fourth intensive session 3, where Kuo is talking about positive magical working. Because we were asking, like, what's the point of doing magic if one is not trying to take control of reality, right? One is trying to accept and surrender and all this. And Kuo says, "Now, let us say, for instance, one has done due diligence in the quotidian details of emotion and balance, and one is beginning to feel the regularity at that indigo center that begins to complete the circuit through which power and purpose may flow. One can safely assume," I'm skipping over some stuff, "one can safely assume that one will be addressing one's shadow self even as one begins to dip the ladle into the cauldron of more focused selfhood, more projective possibilities. How should this be balanced at this more refined level, you may ask? It must involve a kind of release of this dark side from the responsibility to look out for one's safety, one's security. This is a proper role in the full spectrum of selfhood. You are not created as a complex of mind and body and spirit to be fully expected to absorb all influences and stimuli that you encounter. There is a need for a membrane, the balance of homeostasis that creates and recreates one's experience moment to moment. This need for a center does not dissipate as one approaches the throne of power. It becomes all the more necessary. And yet, my friends, and yet, one must become more nimble and more fluid in relating to those things that disturb oneself, that call out for a second look, you see. This is a protection in which you can enlist those more wary parts of the self in cooperating with those higher aspects of self. And here we are in part referring to that self that is nearly beyond polarity, the magical personality. What you would ideally do is call upon this magical personality to comfort and assuage those worries and reflexes of defensiveness that are part and parcel of individuated selfhood. You would let this higher density construct handle these things. And this is not a matter of handing the keys over. It is a nuanced and detailed process, as nuanced and detailed as one's channeling preliminaries, if not greater. It must be felt sincerely so that an actual partnership may obtain. And you can open up and more fully, you can open up more fully to the possibilities of co-creatorship that transcend one's third density hopes and aspirations. So big theme here is the influx of fourth density energies is going to make this all more stark. But I think it's also important to see that, like, our ability to wield more power and therefore become more and more co-creators in more and more abject ways involves, this kind of embrace of the shadow self. And not just an embrace, but a particular embrace, a particular form of integration unique to us, unique to our energy system and our way of expressing these things, brings it in and that can hone this power for good, for service to others, not as a rejection of the dark side of herself, but as a embrace of the dark side of herself. Paradoxically, right? It's all paradoxical when it comes to spirituality, right?
Yeah, and so it's all a paradox, and you can kind of try and grasp some of this intellectually, but really until you grapple with these concepts, kind of engage with them in your daily life and in meditations, it's difficult.
And I know that, like, our circle did some work trying to look at how the shadow side in society, in individuals in society, is leveraged by certain authoritarian personalities. But I just don't see an entry to bring that up in this conversation. I think it's best most of the time when we talk about the shadow self to remember that we're talking about ourselves. And that's usually where most of the work happens. So as much as that session I really would like to read, I just don't think it's appropriate, but I'll put it in the notes in case anybody else wants to.
I definitely think that my first inclination, since you raise the topic, is that trying to manipulate others through their shadow selves, right? Because what would it be but manipulation, is typically something that serves to self or unpolarized entities would do. You don't want to mess with people's shadows, other people's shadows typically, right?
Yeah.
Service to others.
Yeah, and I think that session, just to summarize it, was talking about how individual repressions become sources of power that certain personalities can leverage through the yellow ray complex. I think a Hitler or, some sort of authoritarian that we might know in our present day.
Can you name names?
No, I can't. I have a non-disclosure agreement with this individual. Although, they probably don't have any money anymore to sue me, so. No, I'm just joking. But I'll put that in the notes because it goes more to the social aspects of all of this, and that's not really what our focus has been. But anyway, is there any other topics or aspects of this you want to bring up, Nathan?
No, I mean, it's a very in-depth subject. I mean, we could probably talk endlessly about it, but I think for the purposes of our discussion today, I think we hit a lot of areas, and I think we gave some food for thought for the viewers. So I think we're good as is.
Yep. Only thing left for me is to figure out how you pronounce assuage.
Assuage? I don't know.
Assuage. Yeah, it's something. The funny thing is that, like, I was the instrument who channeled that. So I said it right.
It's
I just,
yeah.
doubting myself. That's funny. Man. Yeah, man. Instrumentality is such a weird thing.
It is.
Well, thanks for listening to this episode. Thanks for joining me on it, Nathan. I am happy that we finally got something recorded, and we're going to try and do these monthly, I think. I think that's a safe way to do it, especially now that I have to do a bunch of video editing for these episodes. Like, it's just easier to do it that way.
And I think both of our jobs these days are pretty, at least mine, you know, because I've had this job for 6 months, pretty busy, so.
Yeah, I'm a principal engineer now, so I got to, like, pay attention to everything. I can't just do my work and
shut the congratulations.
It's a
title. You have a lot of direct... Do you have a lot of direct reports? Or?
I'm not a manager. I'm more like a
team leader,
like an individual contributor. But the idea is that I'm bringing a lot of experience to the table, so I may be ranging over many.
It's not just an idea. You are bringing a lot of experience to the table. I mean,
well, thank you, Nathan. You can flatter me when we're off the call. So, thanks for listening, everybody. In the meantime, stay in the love and light.